Welcome to tonight's keynote lecture. Recent publications include Football and Discrimination, Antisemitism and Beyond, 2021. 4 years after Antisemitism and Racism in Trump's America, from 2020, and Gender and the Politics of Antisemitism in the American Historical Review in 2018. So, Stephanie, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan, for this kind introduction, and thanks to everyone here for coming, after most of you, after already 2 long days of conference, so I really appreciate that. And of course, most of all, I appreciate, or in the first place, that you invited me here to give this lecture, so thanks to the organizers especially. So what you see here behind me is a memorial in the South Russian city of Stavropol. It commemorates the killing of 660 men and women, patients of the Oblast Psychiatric Hospital in the summer of 1942. My colleague, Dr. Irina Rebrova, to whom I owe my knowledge about all this, took this and the other photos which we will be seeing when we were visiting there as part of a round trip to Holocaust memorial sites in southern Russia and North Caucasus in 2019. This monument, and you can see a bit the surroundings, is located on the grounds of the clinic, which, built in 1907, is a beautiful example of the then very modern, very European approach to mental illness. Bright buildings in a green and spacious setting. But the site impressed me not only for this, but for 3 other reasons. First of all, we had arrived the night before by plane via Moscow. And then when I was standing there, very, very far away from Berlin, I was thinking about the German soldiers who had made it all the way down there. And here you see, let me see, we are like somewhere here. And in the next one, you see Stavropol there. So this was the furthest extension of the German occupation in the East. They had made it all the way down there, not by plane, in order to kill 660 sick and defenseless people, because this was among the first things they did upon arrival. Second, at the small celebration we had there in 2019, it was my task to answer the friendly welcome by the hospital's director with a little speech, for which he in turn thanked me by stating that we were the first Germans to come here after 1942. And still, after dedicating so many years to the study of the Holocaust, a remark like this has its impact, especially when you're German. I just said Holocaust, but is this killing part of the Holocaust then, of the history of the Holocaust? And that's exactly this question is the topic of my talk, but let me say beforehand that here in this space, together it is part of the Holocaust, because together with the 660 patients, the Germans killed the Jewish doctors and nurses of the hospital. In other places, these two groups were killed separately, and they were commemorated separately. They are not mentioned on the stone here, but on the other two memorials in Stavropol. One, this one, at the university, by the way, the University of Raisa Gorbachova and Gorbachev, where they met, but that's another story. One at the university commemorating all the victims of the university under occupation, and since 2018 specifically mentioning the Jews among them, here at the side there, with the names of the murdered Jews from the university. And then there is this commemoration site in a forest nearby commemorating the murdered Jews of the city of Stavropol. This monument, by the way, is from 1944, and it originally bore Star of David and named the victims as Jews. This was later then changed into the Red Star and the well-known peaceful Soviet citizens. So what we have here, far away from London and Berlin, is my story for the next 45 minutes in a nutshell. Germans killing different kinds of people for different reasons, or so it seems. Politics of commemoration, but also academic attempts to analyze this catastrophe, do this mainly by focusing on the history of the various victim groups and their specific forms of victimization. In my talk, I wish to turn this perspective around in order to give an overview over the entanglements of anti-Semitism, racism, and biopolitics that characterize National Socialism. So in fact, I will rather look at the German National Socialist vision of society and their attempts to put this vision into practice inside Germany, and then, albeit in a different forms, all over German-dominated Europe. So much of what I will be saying may not really be new to this distinguished audience, for sure, and I apologize in advance, and I also apologize for this very racialized language which I have to use when I'm dealing with Nazi thought. It sounds worse to me in English than in German, I found out. I will use my sort of speech signs, but when I forget them, excuse me for this. I'm grateful for the chance to discuss with you the consequences that our vast knowledge accumulated internationally over decades has or should have, or at least could have, for our present debates on public memorial culture. So to start with, I think it's interesting to note that it was the term racism itself, which emerged in the 1920s, that was used in this early phase to characterize a National Socialist worldview. After the end of the regime based on it, for quite some time, racism became interchangeable with anti-Semitism. You can find this, for example, in the writings of Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno, who used the two terms as synonyms. While it was Hannah Arendt who was the first to reflect on both terms independently, on their similarities and differences. It was only later on that research on the ideologies of biologically based inequality developed into two completely separate areas, research on racism on the one hand and research on anti-Semitism on the other, which today are often diametrically opposed to each other, specifically in the country of the perpetrators. The vehemence and the animosity with which these debates are sometimes conducted in the public sphere are by no means reflected in international research, which is probably why two of the most important works in this respect came from the Anglo-Saxon world, albeit including German editors and authors as well, and both of them were not very much received, even among German scholars, which is also interesting. So, on the basis of research done in West Germany in the late 1970s and 80s, mainly by students of Hans Mommsen like Michael Zimmermann, Ulrich Herbert, or Detlef Peukert, it was in 1991 that Michael Burley and Wolfgang Wippermann finally presented the first interpretation of National Socialist Germany as a racial state. That's the title of the book. And the central thesis of their book was that the National Socialists had pursued a coherent racial policy for which at all levels the scientific and practical work of the academic elite and the institution in general and the institutions in particular had been decisive. The compelling novelty of their approach lay in the concept of race as a fundamental category of social policy, or better, of social engineering, which included both attractive offers for inclusion for those deemed desirable and measures of exclusion for a wide spectrum of undesirables, which ranged from sterilization to workhouse and onto concentration camp and murder. From this perspective, in turn, the mass murder of the Jews appeared as one step, albeit a central one, on the way to achieving the utopia of a racially homogeneous society, and was thus in some not very clear way integrated in the overarching ideological concept of race. It is therefore not surprising that the Burley and Wippermann racial state paradigm, especially in English language research, not only quickly advanced to, I'm quoting Eve Rosenhaft, to the shorthand explanation for understanding the Third Reich, but at the same time remained compatible with the colonial turn in the historiography of National Socialism, which only in Germany was conducted in the form of such a bitter debate as already in the mid-2000s, and now again. Around the time, however, criticism was voiced about various aspects of this all-encompassing explanation of Nazism, which David Pendus, Mark Roseman, and Richard Witzel bundled in a 2017 volume entitled Beyond the Racial State. This critical debate then revolved primarily around the alleged coherence of both Nazi racial thinking and the policies based on it, whereby the direct influence of ideology on state action was again problematized, and thus, last but not least, the question was raised anew of the location of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust in the racial state. So if one deals with the relationship between racial thinking, racial politics, and National Socialism, then it is precisely this that needs to be examined more closely, I think. The interdependencies and respective specifics of racism and anti-Semitism in a system that was characterized by unprecedented violence in its multidirectionality and diversity. There are two things to keep in mind. National Socialism did not produce its own racial theory, so that there was never a master plan that could have been implemented by already existing institutions or institutions set up especially for this purpose. Rather, the Nazi racial doctrine, was a mixture of knowledge and belief that was open to many sides. And as you all know, the historical reservoir of this mixture, of which this mixture availed itself, was undoubtedly the Volkish National and German Völkisch movement of the late 19th and early 20th century, which likewise was characterized ideologically by a high degree of eclecticism. This, however, did not prevent Völkisch groups, associations, and parties from using the concept of race as a master key of their ideas about society. Race explained the past, the present, and the future, was destiny and a challenging task at the same time. Völkisch racial doctrine made use of different set pieces and was therefore able to be connected to very different discourses of modernity in multiple ways, whereby, by the way, the proximity of German colonialism and personal and ideology of both the Völkisch activists and early racial biology is striking. The battles among the various protagonists of German racial thinking is a topic in itself, which would, I think, lead us astray here, especially given its extension and also its craziness. So I would like to call your attention only to what I think is important for understanding its social relevance or its political impact. Given the, and I'm insisting on this, impressive incoherence and confusion of the opposing, mutually competing racial ideas, some Völkisch groups, such as the Deutschbund, early on had transposed the idea of descent or genetics or breeding into that of blood, which is a different language. Already the Nazi party program of 1920 and later in the 1930s consciously spoke of German blood and German-blooded people instead of Germans, Aryans, Nordic, or Teutonians, or whatever. Furthermore, the mystic language of blood linked up nicely with everyday knowledge of the educated German middle class of the time, which since the 19th century was shaped by the romantic notion of a German people as a culturally and ethically superior community of descent, but what was rather less interested in biological ideas of breeding or eradication. So a pamphlet of the Deutschbund, for example, of 1933, read, for example, and I'm quoting, "We believe in the victorious power of blood inheritance, but we do not know the mysterious path it has taken down through the long line of our ancestors." At the same time, the language of blood possessed a further space of racial resonance, namely that of the unchangeable otherness of Jewish and Muslim blood, as had been expressed in the 200-year-long debate in the early modern era about the Spanish blood purity laws, leaving lasting and deep traces in European Christian memory. So it may not be no coincidence that it was the aforementioned Deutschbund that from the outset expressed its fantasies of renewal and salvation exclusively through the quiet but persistent defense against the contagion with Jewish blood. This differed from other Völkisch groups for which anti-Semitism down to the First World War undoubtedly was a constitutive element of their worldview, but not the only one and also not the most important one. Because the Völkisch groups and grouplets differed from each other in terms of their anti-Semitic foundations and correspondingly were also never able to agree on a pathway to solve the so-called Jewish question. sometimes the anti-Semitic animosity was considered spiritual, moral, or idealistic in motivation. At times it was driven by biologistic conceptions. Frequently the Jews were rejected together with other so-called inferior races, such as Slavs, Romanic Latin peoples, and other non-Teutons, and in fact more rarely they were accorded in the focus of universum a certain unique distinctive feature. I'm talking about pre-World War I. In general, Judaism stood more as a code for everything that was to be rejected. Anti-Semitism, as we all know, had become the cultural code of the counter-enlightenment in the German Empire, or from the point of view of the anti-Semites themselves, an indispensable prerequisite for the realization of a German Volkish concept of life and society. It was therefore unthinkable without racism, but, and that was the cause for the lack of clarity and definition that persisted until the end of the Nazi regime, racism itself had no theory of Jews as a race to offer. On the contrary, Jews hardly played any role in the concepts of eugenicists, anthropologists, and race hygienists. Some regarded them as a mixed race with, I'm quoting, Oriental, Mediterranean, Alpine elements. Others viewed them as a people, yet others saw Jews as virtually a kind of spiritual, mental race. None of this means that these scientists were not anti-Semites. In addition to their Christian cultural character, they all shared as a lowest common denominator the notion that Jews were not Germans and should play a little or no role in the German state. So for them, anti-Semitism was ultimately a religious, political in its justifying underpinnings, not racial, theoretically, whatever that means anyhow. And this became clear at the latest when, after 1933, it was a question of putting racial ideas into legal texts. And even scientists like Eugen Fischer had to admit that the problem of racial belonging could ultimately only be solved by, and I'm quoting Fischer, asking, where does he come from? Who is his father? Who is his grandfather, his mother and grandmother? And there we have the Nuremberg laws in a nutshell. In view of the remarkable degree of incoherence that characterizes the racist and anti-Semitic constructs of ideas of the Völkisch-oriented exponents and race biologists and subsequently the National Socialists, it makes sense to look elsewhere for the reasons for their plausibility and persuasiveness. For Uwe Puschner, the most knowledgeable German expert of the Völkisch movement, it is religion that is the Archimedean point of the Völkisch worldview, and I'm quoting him. It not only provided the religion, not only provided the justification for the Völkisch doctrine of salvation, which was as apocalyptic as it was fanatically pursued, of the divine descent and the destiny of the Germans, it gave the Völkisch proponents the very basis in the first place for their anti-egalitarian, racist building of thought. At the same time, these forms of religious fantasies of awakening, of revival and salvation were compatible not only for Catholics and Protestants, but also for the radical atheists and the later National Socialism, they called themselves Gottgläubige, you believers in God, and also to the life-reforming adherents of esoteric thought that together formed, I'm quoting Jost Hermann, the pre-fascist German jungle. The subcutaneous transmission of religious elements into National Socialist anti-Semitism has hardly been researched to date, but it is striking that the idea of Judaism as a counter-race, which was to become virulent especially during the war years, refers back directly to Christian images of Jews that have significantly shaped all denominational Christian variants. Since the Middle Ages, of course, as we know, at the latest, Jews were closely linked to the belief in devils, which started in the High Middle Ages, and thus part of a Manichaean worldview in which they acted as agent of the Antichrist or the world enemy, in Nazi parlance. They were imagined as opponents fantasized as overpowering, who often acted unrecognized and in secret, and ultimately could only be overcome in an imagined final battle, the Armageddon. All these overpowering on the one side, secret agent on the other, we can all find this in the Middle Ages already. And it is, in my view, this extremely powerful religious basis that fundamentally distinguishes anti-Semitism from racism, even in National Socialism, and at the same time permanently radicalized and dynamized the diverse interdependencies between the two. These mystical religious ideas received their concrete political form in the 19th century through the concept of the German people as a nation, whose fate sought to be realized within its within new to founded national borders for the time being. I mean, I'm still in the 19th century. So that's where nationalism comes into the picture. Paradoxically, this specifically German interlinking of people and race had opposing effects both internally and externally, which at the same time may explain its particular power. As a form of radical nationalism, German folkish thinking not only had a shaping impact on identity internally, but was also always directed towards the future. Following Hannah Arendt, Christoph Geulen pointed out this underestimated quality of racism, and one would have to add of anti-Semitism, whose political effect is to be understood as something that is always mobilizing. I mean, society was always mobilized. We always had to move from towards a higher goal that had still had to be achieved, a society which was always in the making. And last but not least, then, borders to be overcome, as it was explicitly manifested, for example, in the settlement project of the Völkisch movement and activists. Both would come to be implemented in concrete domestic and foreign policy in Germany from 1933 onwards. So the implementation of this mishmash of ideas comprised of racist hierarchization, anti-Semitic fantasies of emulation, and modern ideas of social engineering took place from January 30, 1933 onwards. In this melange of delusion, pragmatism, and flexibility so characteristic of Nazi politics as a whole. Due to the incoherence of the underlying racist body of knowledge, the practical policy in this field was characterized by quite a notable wrangling over competences between scientists, Nazi functionaries, and lawyers. In the end, it was all about the power of classification, because we had to do with law, by means of which individuals and groups were differentiated from each other and were rendered objects of different stages of persecution. The individual steps of this implementation, in turn, were all flexibly balancing what was possible in each case. And great importance was always attached to the legal framework and to the involvement of the bourgeois state apparatus, but at the same time, the Nazi Party was always able and willing to act through the media and violent street fighting campaigns to promote certain projects. In this way, it was possible to test out in a pragmatic way what, in the disillusioned words of the witnesses Horkheimer and Adorno of the early 1930s, I'm quoting, what people can be expected to do as long as they hear the threat or the promise that something from the loot will be provided for them personally, end of quote. Precisely this dialectical relationship between exclusion and belonging, between violence and reward, underlies Michael Wild's reflections on the concept and practice of the National Socialist community, and at the core of which he identifies anti-Semitism. Richard Witzel, on the other hand, recently proposed a similar but broader concept of Nazi biopolitics to cover the entire range of racist, eugenic, and social racist measures to create a homogeneous people's folks community on the basis of an allegedly biological selection. It involved both a biologization of tradition, for example, in the racist justification for the persecution of Jews, Sinti and Roma, Black Germans and homosexuals, and at the same time, a biologization of the social when, for example, innate feeble-mindedness or asociality were equated and treated together. Only in the field of eugenics and Wetzel's view, had Nazi lawyers and scientists created a new group that had not previously been biologically determined as such. Persons afflicted with what the Nazis called hereditary diseases, suffering from mental illnesses, severe alcoholism, epilepsy, Huntington's disease, and blindness, as well as physical deformities. After the attacks on political opponents since February 1933 and the April laws restricting occupation for Jews, the precise definition and extent of which was still pending, it is noteworthy that the fresh Nazi regime shows this group, the hereditary sick, the people with hereditary diseases, that had hitherto been an unchallenged part of the Germans or Aryans or Volksgemeinschaft, to become the object of the first violent and general legal measures. The law for the prevention of offspring with hereditary diseases of July 14, 1933, which radicalized a 1932 planned draft for voluntary sterilization, was drafted in the Reich Ministry of the Interior with the collaboration of an expert advisory board for population and racial policy. And this law now of 1933 contained an obligation for doctors to notify the authorities and relegated then decision-making authority to 200 hereditary health courts yet to be set up. In short, a prime example of the involvement of the legal and medical elite in the biopolitical measures of the new government. It created the basis for forced sterilizations, which encompassed a total of 400,000 victims by the end of the war, of whom around 3,000, mostly women, died. And I'm talking now about German women. While this irreversible encroachment on physical integrity was propagandistically accompanied by pictures and reports of the terminal ill, as was later also the case with the so-called euthanasia, the orders were rarely based on medical diagnosis. In fact, 85% of the cases involved questionnaire-based mental imbecility, moral feeble-mindedness, and schizophrenia. That were like 85% of the cases for sterilization. And schizophrenia was always used principally by those who passed the intelligence test but were deemed morally suspect. An exception to this eradication clearly aimed at socially deviant behavior is a purely racist sterilization of the called Rhineland bastards. It is those children who were born to German women and French colonial soldiers during the occupation of the Rhineland. In June 1935, this law was radicalized in two ways. It now allowed also for the castration of homosexuals and sanctioned forced abortions for eugenic reasons. A few months later, the law for the protection of the hereditary health of the German people was passed, which ordered an eugenic screening for all those potential brides and grooms in form of a marriage suitability certificate and marriage bans for all those who were considered genetically inferior according to the recently established criteria. And it's interesting that this had originally been part of a draft law to protect against harmful marriages, Volksschädliche Ehen, the second part of which was then detached and enacted a month earlier as the Nuremberg laws. The ban on mixed-race marriages pronounced there had been had a long conflicting history, since it was simply impossible to give a satisfactory definition for all sides in regard to the races to be protected and those to be excluded and the corresponding criteria. And this was discussed for 2 years, especially regarding the Polish population of the German East. So there was no way of putting this into a legal framework. So in the end, it was limited to the well-known anti-Jewish thrust, not because of its centrality, but because of its feasibility, thanks to the existence of archival material, that is, the Jewish community membership list and the church's records on baptism. And again, shortly afterwards, at the beginning of 1936, the anti-mixed marriage legislation was then extended to other individuals of so-called foreign races. For example, Sinti and Roma, as well as the black Germans, could also be sentenced now for racial defilement. Accordingly, the two laws were then viewed as a racial biological unit and were jointly commented on from a legal perspective by Wilhelm Stuckart and Hans Globke, the latter, as we all probably know, worked together later with Adenauer, was the Chancellor of the Federal Republic. Parallel to the discussion about the marriage ban and anti-homosexual paragraph 175 was tightened in June 35, and shortly thereafter its implementation was assigned to a newly established central office for combating homosexuality and abortion in the Reich Criminal Police Office. Its activity massively increased the pressure of persecution, which from 1937 often resulted in being sent to a concentration camp where homosexuals were traditionally at the bottom of the prisoners' hierarchy, with a correspondingly high number of torture and death. They were also the victims of medical experiments to cure their sexual orientation. However, and this is also important to note, the persecution of homosexual men had already begun in 1933 from the very beginning and reached a first high point four months later, with the looting of the Institute for Sex Research of Magnus Hirschfeld on May 6, 1933, and the famous book burning on Berlin's Opernplatz. And I think it's amazing that this is still being treated as a book burning, when in fact it was an assault of on an institution that researched homosexuality in a liberal way. Other measures with which the new German government wanted to demonstrate its dynamism and agency to take action from the outset included raids on beggars, the homeless and vagrants, efforts for which tens of thousands were briefly taken into custody from September 1933 onwards. Those persons, as well as the permanently unemployed, were now threatened with selective obligatory service, work service, or being committed to workhouses, which in turn entails the risk of getting caught up in the grinding mills of the biological sterilization processes. However, while this was handled very differently, locally and regionally, the law against Berufsverbrecher, dangerous habitual criminals of November 33, so it was all made in the first year, 1933, combined social racist and criminal biological approaches and enabled unlimited preventive detention and criminal biological examinations throughout the Reich, which could also end in sterilization. And as we all know, with the establishment of an unlimited racist police force under Heinrich Himmler from 1936 on, ever more individuals came under focus and were officially recorded, persecuted based on these criteria. As early as 1937, thousands of men classified as asocial or professional criminals were assigned to expand or help construct the Dachau-Buchenwald and Sachsenhausen concentration camps. A year later, the pressure of persecution intensified again due to the possibility of preventive detention, which had existed since December 36. In 38, several raids which culminated in the large-scale Aktion Arbeitsscheu Reich campaign with 10,000 arrested in June 1938 alone, now also included previously convicted Jews and Sinti and Roma, in addition to the other groups already mentioned. This overlapping of different groups during the various steps of their persecution is another important factor to be taken into consideration, and I will come back to this in a second. It is best exemplified by the Sinti and Roma, who were, although in varying degrees, targeted by all racializing measures of persecution. In contrast to other victim groups, science was largely responsible for this, because it was the Racial Hygiene Research Center under Robert Ritter, whose unrivaled activity made a significant contribution to the stringent official registration and treatment of the German Sinti and Roma. In the context of racial, biological, physical, and mental examinations, they were sterilized as morons or as genetically inferior. They were at the same time combated as asocial elements and professional criminals, and since 1936 concentrated in the Reich Central Office for Combating Gypsy Malpractice. Although they were not mentioned in the Nuremberg laws and associated implementing regulations, the accompanying legal commentary aforementioned nonetheless stated that these laws, or the Nuremberg laws, applied not only to Jews but also to so-called gypsies. So, within only 5 years, the racial policy of the Nazi state had developed into a comprehensive biopolitics undergirded by the law and supported by a large number of different institutions, whereby it was precisely the overlapping and complementary measures that contributed significantly to the comprehensive registration, expansion, and radicalization. In addition to workhouses, welfare homes, psychiatric institutions, and prisons, it was ultimately the concentration camps that, starting in 1937, were expanded from places of combating opponents to places of racist general prevention. Between 1936 and the beginning of November 38 alone, the number of people imprisoned in the concentration camps rose from 4,700 to 24,000. And during the nationwide attack on German Jews on November 9th, another 36 men were dragged off and confined in the three large and in any case already overcrowded camps. At the same time, the events of the nights of November 8th and 9th, 1938, mark a massive turning point in the way the German state dealt with its Jewish citizens. And we know from what my colleagues Wolf Gruner's recent work, it was not the numerous shops and synagogues that were destroyed, but above all, the excessive force with which the SRSS and Hitlerjugend broke into private homes, smashing furniture and attacking people, that became deeply imprinted in the victims' memoirs or memories. This spectacle of the open exercise of violence in which more than 1,000 women and men died was also viewed with skepticism and concern by many spectators, since at the same time it destroyed the elusive appearance of lawfulness that had cloaked and concealed above all the measures of persecution. Not least because of this experience, the regime sought to maintain more or less strict secrecy in the years that followed, when during the war, violence was to gradually morph into a policy of murder that was now liberated from all laws. As in 1933, it was again in the field of eugenics that preparations were being made in 1939 for the next and ultimate escalation level. Even before the transfer of power to the Nazi Party, statements had been made, including by Hitler himself, that advocated the eradication of life unworthy of living. But it was only the war that seemed to give these arguments a materially plausible basis, that of the so-called useless eaters. If they had been denied the right to reproduce since 1933, they were now deprived of their right to live. In the years 39 to 41, around more than 90,000 Aryan men, women, and children classified as unfit for work were murdered by poison gas in German sanatoriums and hospitals, that is, on German soil, right in the middle of German towns and people. After the official stop of the so-called T4 operation due to Catholic protest, as you know, the program continued in secret, and patients were now starved to death or killed by lethal injections. The exact number of the second victim group is unknown, but it is estimated that altogether around 250,000 people were killed in Germany, Austria, and the annexed territories like the Sudeten, for example. All those who were considered biologically undesirable or incurably sick were murdered, and as with forced sterilizations, it were the mentally ill and the socially deviant that suffered the most. Later, this procedure was extended to sick concentration camp prisoners, and it was immediately extended to the conquered areas in Eastern Europe as soon as the war began, where it is roughly estimated that between 50,000 and 100,000 people died, and the exact number is not known and probably higher. In Western Europe, the German occupiers refrained from direct killing, but during occupation, it is estimated that in France alone, up to 50,000 patients of mental hospitals and asylums died from hunger, cold, and general neglect, and the same is true for other Western European countries like the Netherlands and Belgium. Altogether, the numbers of those killed as mentally sick amounts to at least 400,000 people, and one can take it for granted that the high percentage of Germans among them is only due to the German defeat. Otherwise, many more people all over Europe would have met that fate. The killing of the incurably sick sets a standard for the war of extermination in the East, first in Poland starting in 1939, and it's showing that it was entirely possible to kill entire population groups, including women and children, practice that had been deemed taboo in traditional notions of war, even if it never was in practice. We know about the continuities, both in connection with the perpetrators who shifted directly from Action T4 to the camps of the Operation Reinhard, and also in the manner of murder, by poison, gas, or firing squad. Specifically, as I said at the beginning, in the Soviet Union, it can be proven that after the invasion of the Wehrmacht, those groups for which there was no place anywhere in the German racist world utopia were shot immediately and often together for various reasons. Psychiatric patients, Roma and Sinti and Jews. This is because ultimately these genocidal murders could be and were only carried out in the context of a racist war of annihilation, the goal of which was at the very least the establishment of a German colonial empire in the East, as a prerequisite for the ultimate utopia of a racially hierarchical world order. As clear as the colonial reference to the conquest of living space in the East were, its undergirding basis, Germans' anti-Slavic racism, was equally incoherent. Traditionally directed from hundreds of years more against Poland, at least in the annexed Polish areas, a certain pragmatism of domination was required, which, for example, led to the inclusion of almost a third of the local population of the German annexed territories in the East into the German Volksliste, a list drawn up according to quite flexible criteria. While here, you know, occupation needed diverse people, so they were like more flexible in this way. At the same time, Polish forced laborers from that same territories, when they were inside Germany, were to be treated like Jews in sexual contacts with German women. However, the Generalplan Ost, the planning basis for the colonial empire to be established, left no doubt. The plan was to exterminate the racially undesirable in the Ostland by means of murder, starvation, or forced labor. Only a small remainder was to continue to be made available to the German colonizers for menial services. And even if these ideas were only partially implemented, given the war's turn in 1943, and only because of the war's turn in 1943, the inherent genocidal violence is clear in the number of victims. Poland lost almost 20% of its population in total. In the Soviet Union, the numbers are not clear, but about 50 million civilian deaths, including 3 million starved prisoners of war and 1 million starved Leningrad children, women, and men. So if one looks at the Germans' actions in Eastern Europe, the murder of the Jews there can certainly be seen as part of this murderous overall event, albeit in the extreme consequence striking. Even the protocol of the Wannsee Conference still echoes in the principle of selecting out those who were fit for work from euthanasia killings and the idea of annihilation by means of labor deployment from the Generalplan East. I'm quoting now from the minutes of the Wannsee Conference. In large work columns, the Jews capable of work are taken to these areas to build roads, which the Jews, who undoubtedly in large measures will be eliminated due to natural reduction. The remainder, in any case, will have to be treated accordingly. End of quote. Much has been argued about the role that economic considerations played in decisions about life and death. Ultimately, economic utility for the victims destined for murder meant only a respite, a postponement that in some cases, thanks to German defeat, was in fact able to prove life-saving. But this was true for Jews as well as for the biologically undesirable and for most Slavic subhumans. And finally, racist considerations that led to distinct occupation regimes in Eastern and Western Europe, as we had already observed for the killing of the incurably sick, are also reflected in the decision to deport the Jews from the occupied countries in Western Europe and some parts of Southern Europe to the East, to specifically build cities of death, I'm quoting Riemsmann here, in order to murder them there in gas chambers. In France, for example, it would have been unwise, to say the least, for the occupiers to kill Jews by firing squads as could be done in the vast territories of Eastern Europe. To put it differently, even the core symbol of the singularity of what we call the Holocaust has at least also one of its roots in the racist logic of the German occupier. It is for all these reasons, for all these obvious entanglements in Nazi theory and practice, that for me, the fundamental difference between the murder of the European Jews and the other designated groups lie in the role that anti-Semitism played for the perpetrators, the National Socialist rulers, and indeed long before they were able to translate it into state policy from 1933 onwards. As shown, the image of the Jew as a world enemy predates the Nazis, but anti-Jewish policies in the early years of the role was were initially characterized more by traditional concepts such as the rollback of emancipation and later on expulsion. Only with the approaching war did the image of the all-powerful Jew suddenly appear real, since he was not just now an eternal enemy, but suddenly stood on all fronts, like in the East and in the West, Bolsheviks, capitalists, etc. Since his famous speech of January 30, 1939, in which Hitler had threatened the end of the Jewish race in Europe in the event of war, he varied his topic again and again in all his speeches to Wehrmacht and SS officers from February to November 1939. He stated, for example, in February 1939, quoting, "The next struggle will be a pure ideological war, that is deliberately a people's and a race war," end of quote. And shortly before the attack on Poland, he called the coming struggle for German sovereignty the physical annihilation of the enemy as the most important war goal, and every listener knew exactly who was meant first. Again, the Jews were killed with the same radical consistency as Sinti, Roma, and the Sikh. But in the imagination of the German government of the time, it was their total disappearance from the face of the earth that in the end would be decisive for German victory or defeat. So in the end, the question we have to ask, for public memory at least, not for Jewish memory, and I do it now in a slightly rude way, do we really want to base our commemoration on the Nazi lunatic mind, on their vision of Jews and the rest of the people they killed, on their hierarchy established, you know, in theory and practice? If we really want to do so, then the focus on this commemoration at least has to encompass the Christian roots, which is left out in most of the commemorational endeavors that I know, and also its link to radical eliminationist nationalism. And I think it is these two elements, religion and nationalism, are much more important than the presumed Nazi racial lunacy, or however it is named. So if we take this into account, the religious, Christian religious root and the nationalistic framework, would this then distance the Holocaust from the history of colonialism? I think not necessarily so, because if we take the Christian universal mission and its practice from the 16th century onward as much into consideration as the European nation state rushed to the colonies in the 19th century, then I think we have a lot of common ground if we take this approach. If, on the other hand, we want to stress the entanglements of different forms of racism and anti-Semitism, it seems to make sense to look specifically at the fluidity of the borders between those groups. Jews, Sinti and Roma, and the Sikh were doomed to death, but practically could survive occasionally for utilitarian reasons. The fit-for-work argument, which at the same time was part of the partial death penalty for slaves, but also for the so-called German asocials, a group which in itself was very close to the psychiatry sick, who again could also survive in internment or by re-education, just like the homosexuals or the political enemies. The latter group, we must not forget, died by the tens of thousands within Germany alone. This approach, the entanglement approach, while also reproducing the perpetrator's hierarchy, directs our interest towards the incoherence of Nazi racial thinking on the one hand, and to the deadliness of Nazi racial politics on the other, and thus to the mindset of the normal perpetrator, his or her motives and scope for action or non-action. It also has the advantage of turning the view towards the utopia, or rather dystopia, that stood at the beginning and end of all killing, the idea of a homogeneous, conflict-free, pure, healthy, and heterosexual society. Both perspectives, I think, are important as far as political education are concerned, but political education, again, I think, is not the same as commemoration. In my mind, commemoration is something distinctly private, and I'm thus always struggling with the term public memory, even though I put it in the title of my own talk, I just realized. So instead of a clear answer, I would like to end with the most impressive memorial that I know, and now we go back to the beginning of my talk and to the south of Russia. Again, to Stavropol, but to a small spa next to Stavropol called Mineralnye Vode. Here, in 1942, 1,000 Jewish men, women, and children were kept for some days in a glass factory and then shot next to it. Immediately after liberation, in the first half of 1943, that is, in the first half of 1943, I mean, this is just February or probably March of 1943, the surviving inhabitants of the town of Mineranje Wode put up the stone for their Jewish neighbors. It reads, "To all those relatives, trusted ones, and friends who were shot here on September 9, 1942 by the German fascist beast. The homeland has avenged you. Let us never forget the bloody atrocity of the enemy." In 1948, next to it, another memorial was erected. Oops. Oops, moment. Just a second. This one. Another memorial was erected, dedicated to the victims of fascism killed there. But, and this was this that you already seen, the stone, the original stone from 43, was not destroyed, but somehow laid to rest behind the new obelisk and somehow, yeah, paid respect in a way, as we can see on this picture, and it was still used at that time for commemorational purposes. In 2019, then, the Russian Jewish Congress erected a monumental granite containing the names of the 1,034 Holocaust victims of the glass fabric in Mineranje Wode. Since the old stone was restored and put up again in 2018, we now have an impressive ensemble of various forms of public commemoration on one space, because it's all one next to each other. And I intentionally have used the word form and not various steps, because I think it lies in the eye of the beholder whether this is necessarily a teleological development or whether each of the forms of commemoration is there in its own right. So let's go back to the inscription of 43. "To all those relatives, trusted ones, and friends who were shot here on September 9th, 42. I was very much touched by it, and I was wondering whether we can learn something from this for our future. It means that right after the event, this probably first Holocaust memorial offers a commemoration based on purely human bonds, on family, but also on friendship, and maybe in some cases only on acquaintance. By doing this, it created a community of commemoration that transcended the ethnic or religious or political group markers that characterize our debates on memory today. Of course, we cannot go back to this moment in time, to 1943, but I do think we should listen to these commemorative messages of the immediate post-war time, of the late 1940s, about which we have also heard here quite a lot at this conference. Based on especially on this recently, you know, unearthed knowledge, I think we can afford, and I think we have to, take a heart and think anew and be maybe more courageous than we have been in the last decades. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephanie, for an extremely rich and wide-ranging lecture, which gives us, I think, a huge amount to discuss. So we have half an hour for questions, and I think there's a mic coming around. Yeah, Paul first. So just hang on, and then Jan will bring the mic down to you. Here. Paul, stick your hand up again.
It was a very stimulating lecture. As somebody who was writing about eugenics and race in the 1980s, I would perhaps like to say that Michael Burley's book came at the end of a process. And in order to write about eugenics and race, there was immense skepticism that had to be overcome. There was a very solid history of anti-Semitism. It was undifferentiated, it was unproblematized. In order to write about eugenics, there was immense skepticism and resistance to overcome. Difficult to think now. To my mind, eugenics is overestimated today. that I think you are unfair. Now, I think just one further point, the dynamic that you show could be a different dynamic. It could be a dynamic of showing that different alliances were made between different factions of eugenicists, it was never solid, with different members of the NSDAP and racial organizations. And to me, it's the clashes that radicalize the process. So it's a different, I would like to suggest this different view. But I
absolutely agree. I think, and I tried to say this, but maybe I didn't make it clear enough, that I think the specific dynamics and radicalization lies precisely in this incoherence of theory and of practice, and then you have institutions, and you have the you know more about the doctors than I do, and the party politics, etc., etc. So this is like what Hans Mommsen has already described as well as this radicalization politics. But then we have the gypsy, the so-called gypsy, so Sinti and Roma population, where all it's centered in one, and in the end it's just as radical. So, yeah, we have both.
Any other questions? Yeah, right at the back, of course.
Some of the acts of genocide, I mean, thinking at the time, the so-called allies, America had carried out eugenics, we know, before the war and after it, I believe, and the USSR and Stalin committed genocide in Ukraine and other places. So the allies are hypocrites. So obviously the reason why the different mentionings of different groups killed is because if we talk about the Jews, that was comfortable, but the problem was other groups had been victims of other genocides, so they kept quiet about it, didn't they? I think, you know, eugenics, the Americans didn't want to talk so much about mentally handicapped people because they used sterilization of black people, didn't they? And the Soviet Union had murdered millions of Polish people and Ukrainians. So, of course, they would be uncomfortable. I talk about the Holocaust and now the Gulag. That's why we have different narratives about different groups that are killed by the Nazis. That's my view.
I think we talked a lot about, we heard a fantastic keynote on Wednesday. Yesterday morning.
Yeah.
Oh, it seems a long time ago. On the politics of commemoration and the political and the sometimes contradictory or unexpected from today's perspective contradictory developments in the development of public memory. And of course, there's always, when we commemorate, it's our present day interest that is driving us and nothing else. And I think this is something we have to be aware of and reflect all the time. This is one thing, but I think another point why certain victim groups were difficult to remember, to put it very cautiously, because families were ashamed to have a psychiatry patient or had somebody with a hereditary sickness maybe. In my own family there is one great-grand aunt that was sterilized, and people wouldn't talk about it because it was. I think it was because of epileptic diseases, and so. But people wouldn't talk about it because it was like a mark on the family, and so there's hardly any research done to the family history of those who were killed in T4, for example. And so it's on the one hand it's the hypocrisy of politics, but it's also of the difficulty of commemoration for certain groups, the asocials, and not to talk about the habitual criminals, which have no lobby whatsoever, which on the one hand has a logic, but on the other hand, if you look at I once looked at archival sources where they wanted to be heard in concentration camp trials, to be heard as witnesses, as to give testimony, and of course they were never accepted, but they wrote it down. And it's heartbreaking, to be honest, because some of them, also to be honest, were, criminals who one would rather see in prison, but others, you know, ended up there by chance, in a like by bad luck and some bad chance, and then they ended up in perpetual prison, and they never got out of it after 45. So the different victim groups have different social standing and family standing as well. And I think this really makes a big difference in our politics of commemoration.
Thank you, Jan. Thank you, Stephanie, for a very wide-ranging and stimulating talk. So